Chapter 6. Legal Challenges. Next morning, Javy drove to the river and parked near the water's edge. The Santa Lura hadn't moved. He was pleased to see that Welly had arrived. Welly wasn't yet 18, but claimed he could cook, pilot, guide, clean, and navigate. Javy knew he was lying.
"Have you seen Mr. O'Reilly?" Javy asked. "The American? No, no sign of him."
Javy drove downtown to the hotel to find Nate. The girl at the front desk hadn't seen Mr. O'Reilly. She phoned his room and no one answered. Javy persuaded her to give him the key. The door was locked but unchained, and Javy entered slowly. The first thing he noticed was the empty bed. Then he saw the bottles. One was empty, and the other half-filled. He saw a bare foot, then stepped closer to see Nate lying between the bed and the wall. Javy gently kicked his foot, and the leg moved. At least he wasn't dead. Javy pulled Nate up from the floor and rolled him onto the bed. His eyes were swollen and still closed, his hair wild, his breathing slow.
"Nate!" Javy said loudly. "Speak to me!"
No response. In the bathroom, he wet a towel with cold water, then wrapped it around Nate's neck. Nate opened his mouth in an effort to speak.
"Where am I?" he said,
his tongue thick and sticky.
"In Brazil, in your hotel room."
"I'm alive, more or less."
Javy carried Nate into the bathroom, into the shower, where he fell onto the plastic floor.
"I'm sorry," Nate said over and over again.
Javy left him there and went downstairs for a pot of strong coffee. It was almost 2 when Welly heard them coming. Javy parked on the bank. There was no sign of the American. Then a head slowly lifted itself from inside the car. The eyes were covered with thick shades, and a cap was pulled as low as possible. Javy walked to the passenger door and helped Mr. O'Reilly out. He looked very sick, with white skin that was wet with sweat, and he was too weak to walk alone. Javy almost carried him up the steps onto the boat where the hammock was waiting. He pushed him into it.
"What's wrong with him?" Welly asked.
"He's drunk."
"But it's only 2 o'clock.
"He's been drunk for a long time."
The Santa Lura moved away from the shore and slowly made its way past Corumbá. Nate slept for 4 hours, and the Santa Lura traveled slowly toward the north. The sun was beginning to fall behind the distant mountains of Bolivia. The air was light and much cooler.
"The water is high," Javy said. "We'll go much faster on the return."
He pointed to a place on the map.
"The first Indian village is in this area. It will take 2, maybe 3 days.
Nate didn't care. Time had stopped. His watch was in his pocket. He'd cheated death, and so every day now was a gift.
"Are you okay?" Javy asked.
"I'm fine. I feel good. This little trip will be good for me."
There was a lot more Javy wanted to ask, but Nate wasn't ready to talk. He went back to his hammock with the papers Josh had given him. He put insect repellent on his arms and legs and began to read. The courtroom filled with members of the Phelan family and their lawyers. At 10 o'clock, Judge Wycliffe came in. The room was silent as he took his place at the front of the court.
"Good morning," he said.
Everyone smiled back. To his great satisfaction, the room was full.
Is everybody here? He asked. I need to identify everyone. The first papers were filed by Rex Phelan.
Hark Geddes jumped to his feet.
Your Honor, I'm Hark Geddes, he said loudly. I represent Mr. Rex Phelan. Thank you. You may take your seat.
Wycliffe went around the tables, taking the names of the heirs and their lawyers. 6 children, 3 ex-wives. Everyone was present.
22 lawyers, Wycliffe said to himself. Do you have the will, Mr. Stafford? He asked.
Josh stood, holding a file.
I do. You represented Troy Phelan, Wycliffe asked. Did you prepare a will for him?
I prepared several.
Did you prepare his last will?
There was a pause. It grew longer as the Phelans leaned closer.
No, I did not, Josh said slowly.
The words were soft, but they cut through the air like thunder. The courtroom grew quiet.
Who prepared his last will and testament?
Wycliffe asked.
Mr. Phelan himself.
Oh, my God,
Hark Geddes said, under his breath, but loud enough for everyone to hear.
When did he sign it? Wycliffe asked. Moments before he jumped to his death. Did he sign it in your presence?
He did.
There were other witnesses. The signing was also videotaped. Please hand me the will.
What is this?
Troy Jr. whispered to the nearest lawyer. The lawyer didn't respond. Fear seized the Phelans, but there was nothing they could do. Was the money slipping away? Wycliffe cleared his throat.
I'm holding here a 1-page document that is the will of Troy Phelan. I will read it straight through.
He read the will. Even Ramble heard the words and understood them. Gina and Cody started crying softly. Rex leaned forward, his face buried in his hands. Mary Ross covered her eyes as her lawyer rubbed her knee. Her husband rubbed the other one. The journalists were excited. They wanted to take notes, but they were afraid of missing a single word. Some couldn't help grinning. Wycliffe finished reading the document. He laid it down and looked around the room. The Phelans sat low in their seats. For the moment, all 22 lawyers were incapable of speech. Then they began to smile. They were going to get rich. Their clients were heavily in debt and had no choice. They had to fight the will. The lawsuit would go on for years. The head of South American missions was a woman named Neva Collier. She'd spent 11 years working in the mountains of New Guinea, so she understood the challenges of the 900 people whose activities she organized. And she was the only person who knew that Rachel Porter had once been Rachel Lane, illegitimate daughter of Troy Phelan. After medical school, Rachel had changed her name to wipe out her past. She had no family. Both adoptive parents had died. She had only Troy, and she was desperate to remove him from her life. After completing the World Tribes training, Rachel had told her secrets to Neva Collier. Neva had promised never to tell anyone about Rachel, including where she was in South America. Sitting in her small, neat office in Houston, Neva read the extraordinary account of Mr. Phelan's will. She'd followed the story since the suicide. Communication with Rachel was slow. They exchanged mail twice a year, in March and August. Rachel usually called once a year from a payphone in Corumbá when she went there for supplies. Neva had spoken to her the year before. Rachel's last vacation had been in 1992. She had no interest in the United States. It was not her home. She belonged with her people. The lawyers met at a hotel in a large room where the tables had been hastily put together in a perfect square. There were 50 people in the room. No Phelans were present, only their legal teams. Hark Geddes started the meeting. He suggested that each lawyer briefly state his or her ideas about the lawsuit. Grit, the lawyer hired by Mary Ross Phelan Jackman and her husband, stood and demanded war.
"We must challenge the will. The old man was crazy. He jumped to his death, and he gave one of the world's great fortunes to an unknown heir. Sounds crazy to me. We can find psychiatrists who'll say he was crazy."
"What about the three who examined him before he jumped?" someone said from across the table.
"That was stupid," Grit said. "Phelan fooled you, and you guys fell for it."
The head of the legal team for Gina and Cody Strong was a woman named Langhorne. She'd once been a professor at Georgetown Law School. Her lecture lasted 10 minutes and covered little new ground. Her conclusion was to challenge the will and hope for an out-of-court settlement. Libigale's lawyer, Wally Bright, was next. He had his own small company that usually handled quick divorces. He wore a dirty suit and a tie that was at least 20 years old. He had nothing prepared, no notes, no thoughts about what he would say next. He talked about injustice in general. Two of Lillian's lawyers stood at the same time. One started a sentence and the other finished it. They repeated what had already been said. The lawyers all agreed. Fight, because A, there was little to lose, B, there was nothing else to do, and C, they would get paid by the hour for fighting. An hour passed before someone mentioned the contest clause in the will. The heirs risked losing what little Troy had left them if they contested the will. The lawyers spent little time considering this. They wanted to fight the will, and they knew their greedy clients would follow their advice. Not one brave voice suggested that the will be accepted. They discussed Rachel and where she might be. Should they try to find her? But they decided not to look for her because they couldn't agree what they would do if they found her. The meeting ended on a pleasant note. The lawyers gave themselves the result they wanted. They left to call their clients and proudly report how much progress they'd made.